And I ended up meeting the wife of the chief pilot of Shoreline Aviation. And they were based up in New Haven, Connecticut. And so up in the Northeast, where I had never gone, never even visited. And they're flying caravans on floats, on amphibs. And they have a route from East Hampton into the East River. And they're doing really cool flights, charter flights. They're flying these very wealthy, sometimes famous people around. And she said, yeah, you should talk to my husband. I think you'd like to fly. Like, I have 5 hours of seaplane time in a J3. You are not interested in me.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 44 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. On The Step is all about float planes and flying boats. You love them, I love them, we all love them. To get in contact with me, my email is thatmallardguy@hotmail.com, or you can follow me on Instagram and send me a message at thatmallardguy. We are up to 63 written reviews on Apple Podcasts. Incredible stuff, really. I am so absolutely driven by the love you all give the show by sharing your review, but the goal is 100, so jump on if you haven't yet and write a review, folks. Do it for the team. Now, I promised it last week, so this week we have a return of the seaplane news headlines. This week we are starting with a seaplane-inspired aeronaval rescue drone, capable of helping rescue people drowning by not just locating them, but also pulling them to the nearest vessel to safety. Designed in the aftermath of the accidents caused by the Boeing 737 MAX, the OASIS aims at being able to help search and rescue teams to reach farther and cover much more ground in lesser time. The autonomous drones are instantly deployed in an emergency situation. They fly in grid patterns to effectively scan waters for any signs of humans. When found, the drone descends to the water's surface, relying on two buoyancy devices to float on top of the water. The human then latches onto the drone as it essentially does the job of a tugboat, pulling the human either to shore or to the nearest rescue vessel. Each drone comes with three air propellers and one water propeller to help it move around. The fact that it flies in the air helps it overcome turbulent waters with ease during search missions. The drone's onboard optical and thermal cameras work effectively in both day and night to help spot signs of life during recon. Survivors can grasp onto the huge pontoons as the drone pulls them to safety. If the weather or tide don't permit a rescue, onboard rescue kits containing food, water, and medicine increases one's chance of survival as the drone immediately pings location and its live stream of the survivor to rescue teams. That article from the yankodesign.com website. Over to Otsu City in the western Japanese prefecture of Shiga, where a seaplane test flight over scenic Lake Biwa has been conducted, aiming to revive such flights for the first time in nearly half a century. Scenic seaplane flights over the country's largest lake had been in operation until 1972. Otsu City wants to attract tourists by reviving the flights. At the city's request, a seaplane operated by a company in Hiroshima Prefecture made three test flights on Tuesday. Passengers who had applied for the flight in advance boarded the seaplane from a dock at the lake. They enjoyed aerial cruising to see a majestic view of adjacent Mount He and the townscape of the nearby ancient capital of Kyoto from the sky. The round-trip flight from Lake Biwa to Kyoto took 30 minutes. The plane made smooth takeoff and landing at the lake in good weather. A woman in her 40s from Kyoto said she was thrilled and the flight was very comfortable. She said she was moved to see the beautiful lake and the streets of Kyoto, where she usually walks, directly beneath her. A man in his 50s from Osaka said he had a great view of the mountain, and he got a real feeling of the vast size of Lake Biwa. Otsu City officials say they will continue to study demand for the scenic flights and prepare for their revival. That article from the nhk.or.jp website. To India, and SpiceJet's seaplane service has been temporarily suspended due to maintenance less than a month after its launch. The aircraft, the 19-seat Twin Otter Series 300, will be sent back to the Maldives less than a month after the service began. The seaplane belongs to Maldivian Aero, which is providing crew, maintenance and insurance to SpiceJet. The seaplane service, run by Spice Shuttle, operates between the Statue of Unity near Kevadia and Subramati Riverfront in Ahmedabad. A SpiceJet spokesperson confirmed the development to Hindustan Times. Seaplane operation has been temporarily suspended due to mandatory aircraft maintenance. Since the maintenance facility, dry and wet dock, is still under construction at Ahmedabad, the aircraft has been sent to our lessors facility in the Maldives. The operation will resume once the aircraft is back. The maintenance facility in Ahmedabad should be ready soon, which would ensure the future maintenance is done here itself, the spokesperson told the paper. The airline stated that the maintenance had been scheduled beforehand. We didn't take any bookings beyond November 27 as this was pre-planned, the spokesperson said. The seaplane service had been halted on November 4 and November 5 due to maintenance also. That article from the moneycontrol.com website. To Australia and Paspaley Aviation, the company I fly the Mallards for, have announced they are conducting two safari-style trips in a Mallard to meet the biannual Seaplane Pilots Association of Australia Seaplane Conference held in Airlie Beach next April 2021. 8 passengers can join the 5-night all-inclusive tour departing Darwin en route to the Whitsundays, stopping at 2 island resorts and an outback lava cave location along the way. The aircraft will then spend 4 nights in the area before heading back in reverse with another 8 lucky guests. The tour was given the go-ahead after the initial success of the Rathmines Mallard Safari in 2019, meeting up with the conference at the popular Rathmines Catalina Festival in Lake Macquarie. For anyone interested in booking on this tour or to receive the full itinerary, please contact me via email, thatmallardguy@hotmail.com. And finally, some news about your favourite seaplane podcast. Last week, On the Step passed the milestone of 30,000 total downloads since it started out in April this year. I am personally amazed by the love and support you have all given this show. From a pipe dream whilst walking my baby boy Finn along the waterfront to where it is today, I am so honoured that I am able to share these outstanding stories for you all, inspiring you to fulfil your own seaplane dreams. And those, folks, are the seaplane news headlines. On to today's guest. Abby Kellett has aviation running through her blood. Growing up in the back seats of World War I era aircraft, Abby is now her own aviator as she teaches the ways of the seaplane world to all types of students, even astronauts. She is also the co-host of everyone's other favourite seaplane podcast, Water Flying by the Seaplane Pilots Association. Let's pull out our camera. Watching from our left, we'll see the flight display of the next vintage flying boat pass by us, demonstrating its slow speed flight characteristics. Snapping photos of her turning away, we'll keep a close eye as she descends to land at the water aerodrome, touching down on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Alrighty, welcome from Florida, co-host of the Seaplane Pilots Association Water Flying Podcast and seaplane instructor Abby Kellett. How are you going, Abby?
So great. Good to be here, Daniel. Thanks for having me.
No worries. I'm really glad to get you on board and share the love again. I was on the SPA or the SPA podcast myself a couple of weeks ago, and now I've got you on board. So really looking forward to having a chat.
Yeah, it's kind of cool to be on the other end of this. I'm not the one interviewing, and you know, I'm the interviewee.
Exactly. And you know what's cool is you don't have your partner in crime next to you to get away with things, do you? So you're all on your own.
I'm in the same room where we do the podcast. I'm talking on my special mic, but it's weird. Steve's not here. Like, I look over and it's just an empty chair.
Yeah. Is that a good thing sometimes? Just seeing that empty chair?
You know, it's definitely quiet in here.
I bet. So yeah. Awesome. Now, we're going to touch on that podcast that you guys are doing. It's great work. I'm really looking forward to hearing future episodes where you kind of delve into some real technical side of seaplane flying. I'm really looking forward to that kind of stuff. You've had some incredible guests on so far, including yours truly. But Abby, why don't we just jump back and talk about your career to start with, because I'd love to hear about how you got into flying seaplanes.
Oh, gosh. So it doesn't seem that long ago that I got into it, but at the same time, it does seem like a long time ago, if that makes any sense. So I got my, kind of going back here, I got my private single engine land in 2014. I was very fortunate to get a scholarship through the James C. Ray Foundation here in Lakeland, Florida, and very generous. They paid my way through my private, and I went on to get my multi-engine private for some reason instead of waiting until I got my commercial. But I went to college, so I'm doing all of this training, Part 61, pretty much whenever I could on holiday breaks, whenever I came home. So I got my private, my instrument, multi, commercial. So I actually, my single engine C private, because I didn't have my commercial yet, so I could only get my single engine C private added onto my license. It was a Christmas present from my mom. So she... Dad kind of laughed at her because he swore that, no, there's no way she's ever going to use this rating. And it's funny because it's the only work I've ever done is on seaplanes.
Yeah, wow. So was that an attraction straight away that once you did that rating, you were just like, this is the avenue I've got to go down?
Oh, I was hooked. Oh, my goodness. So I took my...
like
I
a did good my Stephen King book, was it?
Exactly. Like the character development. He's just such a good writer. Anyway... So I did my rating at Jack Brown Seaplane Base. It was 10 minutes from my house. It is 10 minutes from my house. So just way too convenient that I could wake up at 7:15 and be there for ground school at 7:30.
Yeah, wow. And just jumping back there a little bit, you talked about the scholarship system there. I hear a lot about like the opportunities in the United States for aviation there. Can you tell us a little about that amazing opportunity to get your... Or was it most of it or all of it paid for and kind of ticked off? And tell us a little bit about how you actually got that scholarship.
Oh, my gosh. I can't say enough good things. The only reason I am a pilot right now is because of this scholarship. Believe it or not, I didn't have $10,000 to spend on this rating in high school. I know we're all surprised that I didn't have loads of cash laying around. But it's open to... high school students, I couldn't tell you exactly the age range, but I believe it's Florida high school students. It's the James C. Ray Scholarship, and it's through Sun and Fun, basically. So Sun and Fun, the second largest air show in the United States, they collect so much money for the scholarship that they hand it out to a certain number of high school students every year. Certainly, it's been low this year with COVID and the fact that we didn't have Sun and Fun, the air show. But they're so incredibly generous. I had an interview. I wrote an essay about my experience with aviation, which was basically just my dad. Since I didn't have my private, that's what I needed the scholarship for. And by some luck of the draw, they saw something in me and they gave me a lot of money to get my rating.
Yeah, wow, that's incredible. Because I know the Seaplane Pilots Association also do a scholarship as well, don't they, through... the Seaplane Pilots Foundation, I believe it is.
That's correct.
Yeah, like I said, it's so many opportunities in the States, I believe. Like, I'm sure that Australia and other countries do these small scholarships, but I feel that there's a lot more organizations over there that are just, you know, trying to get people into aviation.
You know, I can't speak to anywhere else, but certainly here, I got the James C. Ray and I received the Ryan Ruano Memorial Scholarship, which is actually kind of amazing. So it's a family and they're just the most amazing people. Their son was killed and they created the scholarship in his name. And I was able to get another rating with this scholarship money. And we stayed in touch and I actually ended up seeing his picture on the wall at an airport I flew up to in New York, which I thought was kind of amazing. I emailed, I don't know if it was his sister, but one of the people in the Scholarship Foundation. I emailed her and I said, it was just cool seeing Ryan on the wall.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your old man there. You said that he had some involvement in aviation. Can you share a bit of light on his career?
My dad is amazing. So he has just had an absolutely amazing career. I just hope to one day, you know, live up to that. So what a legacy he's leaving behind. He's still alive, by the way, so I didn't want to make that sound like he died. He is still alive, but he started flying when he was 15. I mean, he tells the story of saving up pennies to try to fly, and he built his first airplane in wood shop. Wow. He says there were other people that were building birdhouses and sawhorses with absolutely no interest, and he was building an actual airplane, and he did. He built it.
Wow.
Built his first airplane in high school.
That's a good way of saving up money for flying lessons when you can just build your own and start flying that around.
You know, why everyone doesn't do that, I don't know.
Exactly, yeah.
Why didn't you build a Mallard?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a bit hard to get the blueprints for that, and a little bit bigger than I imagine the plane he built. But share a little bit about what he did mostly in his career, because I know he's had one of the most incredible jobs as a engineer, I guess.
Yeah, I want to know his official title. He's the engineering woodworking specialist for World War I aircraft at Fantasy of Flight. And so he's done that for, gosh, as long as my sister's been alive. So 26 years.
Wow.
I want to say he's worked there. He's worked under Kermit Weeks and just had the opportunity to work on some amazing projects. He's done, gosh, the Curtis Jenny. He built a softwood pup. The Benoit is a float plane, seaplane. So he built the Benoit. And if you don't know the story of the Benoit, it's really cool. Just an awesome looking airplane. And it was built in 1913. It had its inaugural flight in 1914. Tony Janus. And it was the first commercially scheduled flight. And it was from St. Pete, Florida to Tampa, Florida. It was a 23-minute flight, 22 miles or something. And they flew the mayor across for their inaugural flight. And so Dad actually had the opportunity to build the Benoit, build a reproduction of that airplane. And I don't think they flew it, but they had it for the 100th anniversary of the Benoit flight in 2014.
Yeah, wow. And so was his career mainly building aircraft or flying as well?
He's had such a cool career. So he likes to say his claim to fame. In 1978, he flew a reproduction of the Wright Flyer 1903 aircraft for the 75th anniversary at Kitty Hawk. And he was on the front page of every newspaper in the country. It was just so cool. So he was, at one point, he was the only pilot that, you know, he still has the airworthiness to fly the aircraft. I think he still has it. And he was the only pilot that was qualified, and he dressed up in the gear and everything and the pictures that they have. So that was kind of his claim to fame, that he was willing to do that, just like the Wright brothers.
Yeah, right. I love how, like, you know, this is the first ever plane that kind of flew, basically. I know there was other types of planes that never made it airborne, but maybe got airborne a little bit. But, you know, this was the one that started flight, the Wright brothers plane. And it's still recognized as an airworthy aircraft. Like, doesn't that... That's great. So that's at Kermit's place as well, is it?
You know, no, it's... gosh, where is it right now? Shoot. It's in the Smithsonian, I want to say, or... Oh, gosh, he's built aircraft for the Smithsonian. I don't know where his aircraft is right now, but it's in a museum. It's being taken care of.
Did he build that aircraft as his own project?
It was a dream that he had. He wanted to fly the 1903, build and fly the 1903 Wright Flyer aircraft. So if you look at the old newspaper clippings, which I have, I've gone through and I've made him, you know, a huge scrapbook of the whole project. His mom was doing the fabric work, so she's doing all the stitching. His dad was there. His brother was there. So it was really a family affair. Certainly he was the head, but I want to say he was in his 20s when he did this. And the fact that he got his entire family together to basically help him fulfill his dream of building this aircraft and flying it.
Oh, good on him. That's incredible. And now I've kind of working at Kermit's place for the last 26 years. That must be an amazing place. I imagine that you kind of almost grew up there. What was that like?
You know, it's funny you say that because I actually did. So it's my older sister, younger brother. We pretty much did grow up there. He had this flight of the day. Kermit used to have, you know, when the museum was open and they had these people going through, it was a flight of the day and they would take out like the L4. They had the French Stomp. They had a German Storch. And so just these little single engine old World War I aircraft, and Dad would put me in the back seat. We'd take off. And he always said I had a nice touch. And I think I've held on to that. Yeah. That I had a nice touch on the stick.
That's so surreal, isn't it? Like, to think that you're just growing up around these airplanes and flying these old World War I airplanes just as part of your childhood. I mean, I had a similar upbringing with the fact that my dad was in aviation as well. But, you know, it's not like I was going out and flying these World War One aircraft on display every day. I mean, I barely kind of went down and actually flew the seaplane with him until I actually finished school and went and did my license myself. So,
really?
Yeah. Not a lot because, you know, I think I mentioned it before, my parents were separated, so I wasn't living with my dad. You know, I didn't have a car myself. Not like I wasn't seeing him, but yeah, he was busy doing that and I was busy doing school and playing sport and everything. So I didn't kind of go down there that often to see him and at work and go flying with him until mainly I started to get my license myself. So, but yeah, that's incredible to hear that story of growing up and just that being your everyday kind of childhood, going out flying these World War One airplanes.
Well, it's interesting because you almost don't realize how cool and unique it is because you know, I got to do that every weekend. It wasn't really that much of an event, but you know, we'd come in, we'd land, there'd be this whole group of people that want to look at the airplane and they come over to me and I'm this little 7-year-old, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, I don't know. Like, don't you want to be a pilot like your dad? I don't know. I'm 7. Yeah.
It's so funny because, like, you know, we've got our boy turns 1 this Friday, and
happy birthday!
Yeah, thank you. Happy birthday, Finn, if you're listening. It's just so crazy the innocence of a child, like how you can. He doesn't know what his life is. He just knows, like, the environment he's around. Do you know what I mean? So I actually took him out on a mate of mine is a doctor who's a big fan of the show. Ben, he has a private Baron up here in Darwin, and we went out and just went for a burn around sunset, and I took Finn up for a fly with us, and you know, just no idea what's going on. He's right in the back of this plane, you know, and just taking it all in as he takes in everything, you know. So it's incredible as a kid. You just kind of grow up with whatever you've got dealt in front of you at the time, don't you? You don't really kind of think about it as being special until you look back at it as an older adult and be like, wow, that was actually very unique.
It's true, and how it shaped you. You know, you don't see it now, even if you don't necessarily see that they're excited about it, it sticks with them and it really forms who they are as people.
Yeah, exactly. So tell us now about the seaplane side of things.
So the seaplane side of things, for me, so, you know, I got my private in, 2017. I got my single engine C as a Christmas present. Never thought I'd use it again. Had just graduated school. And it's kind of interesting. I started going to this gym in Winter Haven, Florida. And I was living back home and just kind of working on ratings. I was working on my CFI at the time. And I ended up meeting the wife of the chief pilot of Shoreline Aviation. And they were based up in New Haven, Connecticut. And so up in the Northeast, where I had never gone, never even visited. And they're flying caravans on floats, on amphibs. And they have a route from East Hampton into the East River. And they're doing really cool flights, charter flights. They're flying these very wealthy, sometimes famous people around. And she said, yeah, you should talk to my husband. I think you'd like to fly. I'm like, I have 5 hours of seaplane time in a J3. You are not interested in me. I can entertain you in the airplane if you want that, but I am not qualified to be in this caravan. And I talked to Eric Weaver, and he offered me a really, really cool job flying these caravans up in the Northeast.
So I've spoke to Sarah Tamar about those jobs. She was working at a different company, I believe.
Fly the Whale?
No, it was Tailwind. She was working at Tailwind. Okay. And this is a similar operation, isn't it? With a co-pilot in the right-hand seat, similar to Tropic Ocean Airways as well?
Exactly. Very similar. Very similar. So it was Tropic, Fly the Whale, Shoreline Aviation. And Shoreline Aviation, I was very impressed with. I didn't, you know, shop around or anything, but Shoreline Aviation just impressed me with their maintenance. Like, the captains used to, we'd get out of the airplane and we'd be helping the passengers out and they'd be, you know, casually chatting with us. And I had this one captain, Steve, who would go over to the airplane and swipe at the grease and he'd say, it's clean grease. Look at these airplanes. maintenance keeps them so clean that there's clean grease on this airplane.
Yeah.
And that just impressed me to no end, the fact that I was flying stellar airplanes.
What an opportunity, isn't it? Like, to get a start in the seaplane industry, because it is quite hard these days to kind of to break into that seaplane industry with no float time or little, you know, just a float endorsement. But to go straight up into the right-hand seat of a caravan, you know, quite a, it must have been pretty daunting, the size of that airplane to start off with, especially going from, I imagine, a little cub when you did your float plane endorsement.
A J3 cub to a Cessna 208 caravan. Yes, I want to say that there was a little bit of a learning curve there, but just the captains that took a chance on me, and I learned so much from flying with these guys. Eric Weaver, just an amazing, amazing pilot. And just the fact that, yeah, she has 5 hours, but she's got a good attitude. I think I would spend time with her in the cockpit, you know.
Yeah.
That's really what you want. You know, you want to enjoy the flight and everything, and certainly you want someone who's qualified. But flying with these captains, I think that hands-on experience was something that is nothing that I could have learned in a book. It really is. You have to have that break when you're getting into this career. You have to have someone take a chance on you and say, she's worth taking the time to teach. She's worth the investment.
Yeah, exactly. And it's such a, you know, with the seaplane endorsement, there's so much that you learn after the endorsement. Like, and we'll talk about your instructing in a moment, but, and what you try to pass on to your students. But you probably saw this as well, that how much do you learn outside of your endorsement once you're actually flying commercially. So to be able to just sit kind of on the side a little bit, still be part of a crew for the airplane, and awesome to have a job and get paid to do this, but just to kind of sit back a little bit, not be the guy in charge, but learn all these kind of intricacies of flying floats from someone who knows what they're doing. You know, what an incredible opportunity.
And the fact that they say that the number of people that can fly into the East River safely and successfully day after day, week after week, year after year is a diminishing population. And so the fact that I knew that I was getting trained by people who were top of the field, that had operated in that area and done the Throgs route 1,000 feet over LaGuardia, like we were flying 1,000 feet over the busiest airport in the country. That still blows my mind to think about. Like, yeah. We're looking down and, you know, there's people taxiing out, coming in, and we're 1,000 feet right over the center, just trying to get to that East River exclusion. And just the confidence that these guys have because they've been in the industry for so long. So it really is the responsibility of these guys to, you know, bring young people in and get them up to speed, because that's who's going to be taking over for you.
Yeah, that's true. I remember doing a NAV, you know, I did my training in Geelong. And one of our private pilot navs was to overfly Melbourne Airport, which is about, it's about an hour car drive. So imagine it's maybe about 20 minutes to get, maybe 25 minutes to get over the top or something like that. But to clear Melbourne Airport, we had to climb, I think it was to 7,000 feet to climb over and get over the top of the airport. And that was tracking directly over the top. So for you to fly over the top of LaGuardia at 1,000 feet, must be incredible. Was there planes taking off and landing at the same time, or was it just in a break in the traffic?
Nope. It's constant. Like, if you fly in that airspace, you're just constantly hitting that button. Traffic, 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
That was my entire job, trying to get in there. If I wasn't the one flying, I'm pressing that button to silence it.
Yeah.
There is traffic everywhere. You got helicopters, you got caravans, you got these people just swooshing by you. And so there is no break. It's constant. And so it's really just keeping your eyes out. LaGuardia is trying to hold your hand as much as they can. But I mean, you're at 1,000 feet. You're about to hop down into the East River, which, you know, you got New York and then you got New Jersey on one side. It's hairy. It can be if you're not doing the right thing and right on your game.
Yeah. So what was the flying like there? How much did you enjoy the seaplane flying in that area? Was there a lot of runway stuff as well, or how did it all work?
You know, it's interesting because since I came back and I'm teaching at Jack Brown's here in Winter Haven, it's hard to remember all of the seaplane stuff that we were doing, because it kind of felt like it was almost just an afterthought. You know, yeah, so we can land on the water so that we can get to the dock. But It was interesting in the sense that there is definitely a skill to get in and out of the East River without breaking anything, because you've got these ferry boat wakes. I mean, you've got jet skis hopping around. You've got other seaplanes. Not breaking anything is an absolute challenge. There was one time we were coming up to the 23rd Street dock, this not the Skyport, but just the 23rd Street seaplane dock. And how it is you're coming into it, and the left side of the aircraft is coming up to the dock. And right after the dock, there is this canal where all the boats, all the ferry boats are going in and parking. And so if you miss the dock, you could come nose to nose with a ferry boat that's coming out and absolutely surprise the heck out of you. And so you're very aware of where everything is, very hyper during that time. So if you miss the dock, you got to have an escape plan, certainly. So it was flying in the East River, you know, trying not to break anything. Going around was an option, of course, it always is. But you really want to get on the water, because getting on the water versus going around and possibly hitting something midair, you know, both options are pretty terrible. Yeah, so you just do your best. It takes a lot of skill, a lot of quick thinking.
Sounds full on. I remember Sarah telling me about that as well. And yeah, her experience was pretty incredible flying in and out of there. And she still is, I believe. So did that then lead down to Jack Brown's as an instructing role? And what kind of led you down the instructing path?
So I finished my season up at Shoreline. There was some changeover going on where they were looking for captains, and I wasn't quite there yet to move into the left seat because I was still getting trained. And so I returned home. I'm working on my CFI, and I sort of, because I've always sort of been around at Brown's, it's a cool place to hang out, and I've got done all my check rides with Chuck Brown, and so they knew me down there, and I think I must have been doing my commercial land, and Ben happens to come through as I'm doing my oral exam with Chuck Brown. I say, "Hey, Ben, will you hire me if I get my CFI?" And he sort of, "Oh, we'll see. We know you, yeah." So I came back and I said, "Ben, I really want this job. I think I would be a good fit." I got my CFI, my ticket, and they had a spot open for me.
And what was that like moving into Brown's? And so, as you mentioned, 10 minutes from your home, that's ideal to have a seaplane job just 10 minutes from home.
Oh, so convenient. Just so convenient. So it's certainly the change going from flying the caravans up in New York to flying with a different student every other day. It's fun. I obviously like talking to people. So it's neat having different people come in, and you get to learn from their experiences, and you have airline captains, and you have ag pilots, you have other seaplane pilots. You have just this whole array of people that are coming here for a little bit of fun in a seaplane, looking for that rating or just looking to fly around and bounce on a couple lakes. And it's really refined my skills, because I'll look back on the seaplane flying that we did up in New York in the caravans. And, you know, did I recognize when I was actually on a true step taxi? Did I recognize, you know, how I could have stopped the porpoising a little bit more precisely? And working at Brown's in just the J3, I feel like it's definitely refined my skills in a seaplane.
Yeah. And what about that whole, you know, everyone I kind of think starts off in the small aircraft as they normally do. You know, even with seaplanes, they generally go, especially in the States, to Brown seaplane base and, you know, get their seaplane endorsement through you guys on the Cub. And generally the progress is to go up in bigger size aircraft. Now, you've started off flying floats on a Cessna Caravan, and now you're coming back to the Cub. How did you find that? Did you kind of get that bit of a, I need to stay on a bigger aeroplane because I'm on the Caravan?
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I've never actually really thought of it as a downgrade in any way. I have such respect for the J3. It trained people for the war to fly these other amazing, fast, big, heavy aircraft. They were in a J3. And so it's sort of the time machine of taking you back to, this is just flying an airplane. get the buttons out of there. There's nothing in here worth looking at besides the back of my head. Because, you know, the student's in the back seat and your instructor's in the front seat. So yeah. Look outside. It's much more interesting. Fly the airplane. It's getting really quiet. You probably don't have any airspeed. You need to do something about that. So it's just common sense flying. It's flying by the seat of your pants, which is what we've always said. But it really is. It's just common sense, intuitive flying. It asks the question, can you fly an airplane?
No, that's awesome. And like you said, it's only a downgrade when you think of it that way, isn't it? Like if you're thinking that it's an upgrade, basically, you know, it's whatever you want to put it, really, isn't it?
Exactly. It's almost like an upgrade of knowledge, even if it's like a downgrade, like quotation marks, downgrade of technology.
Yeah.
But it's still an airplane. I mean, yeah. You got a Mallard, you got an Otter, you got a Caravan, you got a J3. They're just airplanes. You got to recognize where your step is. You got to recognize that pitch attitude. You know, it's just common sense flying an airplane. Can you get in and out of a body of water? Make that decision. No matter what you're in, you got to be doing these same decision-making things, I want to say. So it's definitely, it's been quite a learning experience, and getting to share that information, you know, what I learned up in New York and what I've learned here teaching is so incredibly amazing. Getting to share that with other people and having airline pilots look at me, my little 24-year-old self, and say, I think she has something to share with me, and I think she's worth listening to. It's really cool. It's really pretty cool that someone sees that, because I do. I have something to say. I have information that they want. I don't know everything, like I, at all. They go to the check ride, and they learn something new in the check ride. Like, oh, Abby didn't teach me that. Well, there's a different way to do it. There's more than one way to achieve the objective here. And it's cool because you fly with someone like Ben, who's flown in Alaska, or you fly with someone like John Brown, who's flown so many different things in so many different places. You're going to learn something from them. And, you know, talking to you and flying the Mallard, you're going to learn something.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's such a good, you know, good way of thinking. And I think everyone will learn from that, you know, just hearing you say that. It's not all about kind of the plane that you're flying, or it's just about being in the air, isn't it? And learning from others. So, Abby, tell us a little bit about what it's like as a day in the life of a Jack Brown's instructor. Tell us about you know, the whole process you go through to give someone a seaplane endorsement.
Well, it's a little quiet today. We are currently getting hit by what's going to be a hurricane, so we've sort of been grounded today, which is a good thing. Time to spare, go by air. That old saying. But as far as the life, the what goes on in this whole thing, it's a 2-day course. So people arrive at 7:30. They're in ground school by 8. We're in the air by 10. And we do about 2.5 to 3 hours the first day of flying and training. And then the second day, we fly, do whatever they need to do to clean up. A lot of the times it takes more than 5 hours. The course is 5 hours, but, you know, if you're not current proficient, if you're having trouble just grasping the glassy water landing, because we don't have actual glassy water conditions. So I'm asking you to imagine it and be creative, and you're having trouble with that, it's going to take more time. And so, you know, you finish whatever training you need to, you go for the check ride, and you have that add-on rating to your license. And it's a lot of work. I like to say that it's a fire hose of information that we attach the student to. And if you can just hold on to some percentage of each flight, if you can hold on to 20% the first flight, maybe 40% the second flight. So work your way up where you can hold a little bit more information.
Yep.
But it is a lot. It is a lot of information.
You know, it sounds very regimented, you know, the process you guys go through to knock out these students, you know, like such, you've got it down to the time frame. I mean, over here, because there's not that demand, I guess, for float plan endorsements, you know, I guess people just kind of organize, come in at this time and we'll see when we go flying, and, you know, I might have to take a scenic flight during the middle of the day just because my business is also about doing scenics rather than just doing, you know, training. But you guys have got it down to an art, don't you? Like specific times, get here, let's get in the plane here. Like it's really like almost like a seaplane pilot factory.
You know, we really don't like to say that because everyone is different. And you've really, people come in and I give kind of my brief before I go into my ground school, if I'm teaching ground school that day. And I say 5 hours doesn't guarantee you a sign off and a check ride. It's at the discretion of your flight instructor and yourself to decide if you're ready. So no one's signing you off for a check ride if they think that you're going to hurt yourself or hurt the examiner.
Yeah.
That's not the goal. And so if you need more time will be given to you. And it's the reason people are able to get this thing done in 2 days is because they come in with a good attitude. They leave their ego at the door. That's a huge thing. If you come in thinking that you are just the coolest thing since sliced bread because you are a 40-year captain at American, the J3 will humble you. It won't try to hurt you necessarily, but it will humble you. You don't have anything to look at inside. You are just flying pitch attitude. And that's really it. So if you need more time will be given to you. We make no assumptions about people. People aren't blueprint copies of the other. Every student's different and everyone has different needs.
Exactly. And when you're running a flight school like you guys are, like, and also the incredible amount of lakes that are around your area, like you have so many options.
Oh my God. Yes.
Yeah, it's incredible. I can't wait to get over there one day once all this COVID rubbish is finished up and we can kind of go back to some sort of normality. And come and visit you guys and check out just the amount of lakes that are over there. It's insane. We just have nothing like that over in Australia. It's a lot easier to run a school, I imagine, and to kind of keep to a schedule when you've got that availability with aircraft and everything as well. I see on your Instagram you had an amazing student pilot come in the other day who has a lot of experience. He has experience out of this world almost, doesn't he?
I posted that picture. so he, Story Musgrave, he's been on every shuttle mission. He fixed Hubble. who can say that? I'm just amazing man, amazing stories that he had. We got to go out to lunch a couple times. I had the pleasure of flying with him and training him in a J3. He has an air cam on floats and really good looking airplane. He was down in Sebring. I think he lives in Kissimmee. So the airplane travels with him and he's just going to have so much fun in an air cam because he's an artist. He's a photographer and the air cam was literally built to be a photography vehicle.
Yeah.
And so you take these amazing, you know, it's an open cockpit, so you take these amazing non-obstructed pictures and videos. You're flying at 50 feet above the water.
Yeah.
Nothing better.
Was it a bit intimidating having him in the back seat of the Cub?
You know, we actually have him on the podcast, and we talked about that a little bit. And it really wasn't. It was at the beginning. He came in with this whole stack of books that the T-38 that he flew for NASA and he'd sign it for all of us. And he came in, you know, as a superstar, as an astronaut, but in the back of that J3, you're just a student.
Yeah.
You can hurt me like any other student. You can excel like any other student. I have to treat you like every other student. My hand is, you know, pretty much hovering over the controls. I'm ready to get us out of a situation. I make no assumptions about anyone. I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, certainly, but I don't know who you are. I don't know what your abilities are. You are a student.
Yeah, it's so cool that you're able to share that experience with him, and it's awesome to hear him, you know, getting around in that amazing air cam. I'm really looking forward to kind of getting someone who owns the air cam, or even the inventor. I've got his name on my list as well of people to interview. Abby, you mentioned there that the podcast as well. So, you know, recently you guys have started this awesome podcast, Water Flying. What's been your involvement in the spa before kind of joining Steve on the podcast there?
So I've been a member pretty much since I got my private single engine C, and I've been involved in a sense, but certainly, you know, going to school and working up at Shoreline, you get a little bit out of the organization. But I came back here and I started working at Jack Brown's teaching, and the SBA is about 2 minutes away from Jack Brown's. It's located at Winter Haven Airport, the FBO. And so the commute from Jack Brown's over here is very convenient, which is probably not the driving force of why I'm here. But I see it as an organization where they're trying to bring the seaplane flying and protect it for people that are already flying seaplanes. But they know how cool it is. And you know, too, I mean, what a cool thing that we get to do this. And we want to share it with people. We want other people to know it. It's not a big secret that we're trying to keep from the aviation or public community. We want other people to know that this is a cool part of aviation, seaplane flying.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing what you and Steve are doing, and the whole organization really, to protect and promote seaplane flying. It's you know, it's no secret now that I've mentioned, you know, on the last probably five or six episodes now, that the Seaplane Pilot Association are actually now sponsoring On the Step and helping me achieve my goals with this podcast, and kind of sharing that, you know, how amazing the seaplane world is, through, you know, stories of pilots from all around the world. So it's incredible to have you guys on board. And I was thinking about it today. It was just, it's a really awesome partnership that you got, that I've got you guys. You know, I don't want to try and have someone on this show who sells couches or, you know, makeup or I don't know, like what, something that's completely irrelevant. I love the fact that the company that I'm, or the organization that I'm shouting out at the start of the episode, because you guys are helping me with this podcast, is a company or an organization that is completely going back into our industry and making sure that they promote and protect our way of life, flying seaplanes. It's just, it's the perfect combination. So I'm really excited to have you guys on board. And
that's just a really lovely way of putting it. And we're really excited to have you on the team. You know, we're all working towards the same goal. We want that same objective, to protect and promote water flying. And I can't think of anything better than, you know, working together, finding someone as passionate as yourself across the world. And we all have the same goal and we can achieve that together.
Exactly. Yeah. So I might as well mention it now, that there is a link in the show notes down below if anyone wants to come on board and help out the Seaplane Pilots Association. Abby, could you share a few things that you know, members get? I don't want to make this sound like an ad, but you're a member. So tell us about what you love about the Seaplane Pilots Association as a member.
As a member, so as a member, you get a full glossy water flying magazine every 2 months. And the last issue that came out is the AirCam issue about Mark Twombly, our editor, getting his AirCam multi-engine C rating, which is pretty cool because I actually got my multi-engine C in the AirCam as well. That was a pretty neat ride. And we have the water landing directory, which is a constantly evolving member promoting, member updating, living thing, which is available in an app form, where you can actually find out if a water area is available to seaplane use, which is really important. You know, you don't want to be flying into anything that's not open for seaplane use and angering everyone and making more of the area closed to seaplanes. So certainly using that, you have access to that as a member. You have the water landing directory, the magazine. You have access to us. We have community gatherings. We have the corn roast, which I actually came on this year as the assistant to the director at the Seaplane Pilots Association. So I haven't gotten to go to the corn roast, and I didn't get to go to any of the other events this year because it's 2020 and this is a hot mess of a year, but I'm really looking forward to that. So you have these members get togethers. You have the trips that they do. They did a trip to Lake Como in Italy to fly seaplanes. They've done member trips to Seattle to fly at Kenmore Air. They've done member trips to Southern Seaplanes in Louisiana to fly there. And it's getting to be a part of a community, and we're all working together to, you know, defeat those invasive species, to make fish and wildlife happy, so that we can continue to operate and be seaplane pilots.
Yeah, that's awesome. And have you got any plans to be on any of those member trips for the future?
Oh, Daniel, I have big plans. So I do have plans to be on those member trips. Steve is promising me trips, which is, it makes working in the office worth it because I know I can go out and fly. And I don't know where we're talking about this year or next year, but I suppose that's all dependent on COVID. So everything's a little up in the air now, no pun intended.
Yeah. And I know that, like, there's, you know, there's also the Seaplane Pilot Association in Australia, which I'm a committee member of now as well. Do you know of any other seaplane pilot associations in other countries? I'm not actually aware myself.
You know, that's a really good question, actually.
I'll have to double check with Steve and get back to everyone about that one, because I've never kind of thought about that. But surely there is. There's some sort of seaplane pilots groups, surely, around the world. But yeah, we'll have to check back with that one. But Abby, we're kind of getting now to the end of the show, and you know what I love to finish with here is the world-famous splash and dash questionnaire. just like the land plane touch and go, the seaplane splash and dash, we're going to touch on a few seaplane-related questions, starting off with what is your favorite seaplane that you've flown so far?
The Super Cub.
Awesome. Not the Air Cam.
Oh, man, I forgot about the Air Cam. Wait, can I change my answer?
Sure.
Okay, good. I don't know. It's a toss-up because the Super Cub's
fun. You just said you want to change your answer. So it's either change your answer or it's the Super Cub. It's one or the other.
Oh, this is just too high of stakes. So the Super Cub is fun, but I have to fly in the backseat because I'm the instructor. And so I don't get to see anything. But it's still a fun airplane to fly, even though I'm just sitting there and telling the student where to go. The Air Cam was cool because I got to be in the front seat, and I actually did get to fly that as a student getting my multi-engine C. Oh, gosh. Air Cam. That's my final answer. It's the Air Cam.
Lock it in. Lock it in. Air Cam.
Pressing the button.
Was there any World War I seaplanes that you got to backseat with your old man?
You know, my dad's actually not seaplane rated.
Oh, God.
I know.
He said he was cool.
I know. That's what I say. But I actually have a really good answer for this one. So you know how people, they get into seaplane flying because they've been flying airlines or they've been doing something for so long and they've forgotten that love of flying?
Yeah.
And seaplanes get them back into it. My thought is my dad has been doing what he's loved for decades. So he hasn't really been looking for an outlet to get back into that love of aviation. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You should write a book. That was incredible.
Just a book about that? Okay.
Yeah.
Making a note.
That's a good start to a book anyway. All right. You've got a lake, a river, some open ocean maybe, or I don't know if you've done Coral Cays yet. What's been your favorite place to land a seaplane?
The East River.
Just the hype of it all?
Yeah. It's so challenging and there's so much going on. And, you know, are you going to land right behind that ferry boat to avoid the wake that's kind of V-shaping away, and you land right after it and everyone's looking at you. You are the coolest thing on the East River. So yes, the East River.
That's pretty cool. What about dream seaplane to fly?
Gosh, I have to think about that. I'd love to try out the Icon just because it seems like such an antithesis to the J3. You know, the J3 with the altimeter doesn't work, the airspeed's not accurate, the tack's sort of reading correctly. And then you have the Icon, which is basically just a computer game. And I'm terrible at computer games, but I think it would be kind of fun to try that out. The Sunderland.
Yep.
Would be neat, flying something that big.
Just because I know Kermit's got one, doesn't he, the Sunderland?
He does. Dad actually got to fly with Kermit in that.
Does it still fly?
I want to say no.
No, you want to say yes, but you think it doesn't fly.
You're right. You're not wrong. I do want that to be flying.
Now, you mentioned the Martin Mars as well.
So my goal, you know, I said I have big plans and I want to do firebombing.
Oh.
So your podcast, Craig Patton, that you talk to, I'm listening to that. And I'm taking notes and oh my gosh, he's got such good information. And just being able to contribute to the community and keep people safe like that, I can't imagine any better way to use an airplane and a better reason to burn a bunch of fuel than trying to keep people safe like that.
Yeah, that's true.
Probably the Mars. If I had a final answer, the button is pressed, the Martin Mars.
That's pretty cool. You wouldn't have actually heard, but I've got the Martin Mars episode coming up
completely.
About, yes, with Peter Killen. Everyone listening right now would know and probably have all been recovered from their hangover of that incredible episode with him. But right now, Abby, you don't know that he's coming on.
Oh my gosh.
So,
I'm excited.
Yeah. So you probably just answered this one, but dream seaplane job, is that firebombing?
I think it would be.
On a scooper. Yeah.
On a scooper. You know, it's not so much because, you know, some people have the, I want to fly heavy, I want to fly this. I'm not really too worried about what I'm flying. It's the mission. I would really do anything if it meant contributing to the mission of, you know, saving the environment and saving people's homes and lives. So if that was in a Fireboss or if that was in, you know, a Martin Mars, whatever, I'll fly whatever they put me in to achieve the objective.
Oh, that's really cool. Glass out day on a lake. What aircraft would you like to be in?
A glassy day on a lake?
Yeah. Not the Cub?
I want something with really good visibility so that I can remind myself how little I can see. So probably the Air Cam.
Okay.
Probably the Air Cam.
Yep.
Because you can look out and pretty much see nothing but mirror. And I think it really it cements it in your brain how scary glassy water can be, but how beautiful it is.
True. It is very beautiful, isn't it?
It is.
But very threatening.
Oh, yeah. Bite ya.
Best looking seaplane?
See, I want to say the Benoit, just because I got to see that up close and I got to see the work that Dad did on it. And just the craftsmanship is stupendous. I mean, the woodworking and the love that went into creating that airplane. So the Benoit.
What about piston or turbine?
Piston.
Piston, right.
I don't like over torquing anything. It freaks me out.
Okay. And finally, what kind of advice would you give for aspiring seaplane pilots? You probably hear this question asked a lot and answered a lot through the show, but what's been your best advice that you've received that you could pass on to others to try and get into the seaplane industry?
Keep talking to people and listening to stories, listening to podcasts. There's a really good podcast now, that Mallard guy. Yeah, I've heard of him. And just people have such good information out there. And sometimes it feels like it's hidden and people are trying to keep it a secret. Like, you know, I met Caroline Weaver. I met the wife of the chief pilot of Shoreline Aviation at the gym. And it's really just a matter of making yourself someone that people want to sit in the airplane with for an extended amount of time. So fly everything you can, talk to as many people as you can, stay positive. Sometimes it just sort of falls in your lap and you end up where you need to be.
Awesome. Well, Abby, it's been awesome having you on the step. I really hope you've had fun and keep up the great work teaching astronauts how to fly seaplanes and and on the keeping Steve in check on the great podcast you guys are putting out, Water Flying Podcast. Hope you've had fun and thanks for coming on the step.
Oh, thank you so much, Daniel. It was a pleasure.
And that's the show for today, folks. Thanks to Abby for coming on the show and sharing her story. If you haven't tuned into the Seaplane Pilots Association Water Flying Podcast, go check it out. They do a great job over there. Folks, this week's new patron is Tim Goose, who is an Aussie, also a member of the Seaplane Pilots Association of Australia. Good on you, Tim. Tim has joined Patreon as a Super Club Floatplane member. Thanks, Tim, for your support of the show. And if anyone else wants to join the growing Patreon group for as little as $3 a month, see the link in the show notes below. Don't forget to share this show, folks. Tell a friend or colleague and help out even further with a review on Apple Podcasts. They are much appreciated. Until next time, everyone, thanks again for coming on The Step.